Department of Community and Economic Development, the Division of Trade and Development. I am a mineral specialist with them at this time. Today I'm going to talk briefly about opportunities for mining in Alaska, and then you have a lot of good experts in the room here that are going to fill you in a lot of good details. Despite record low prices for metals and coal, the preliminary estimates for 1999 mineral industry are $45 million invested in exploration, $18 million invested in development projects, and $986 million in production, for an overall value at about $1.049 billion in Alaska. Several medium-sized mines, Illinois Creek, Nixon Fork, Alaska Gold, and a number of small placer mines were closed in 1999. But Red Dog near Kotzebue increased their production and continues to be a world largest producer of zinc. Greens Creek Mine on Admiralty Island remains one of the largest producers of silver in the U.S., and Fort Knox Mine near Fairbanks is Alaska's largest gold producer, with an average daily production of 1,000 ounces of gold. The Pogo gold deposit north of Delta, which I'll show you on the map, spurred about 60% of the exploration conducted in Alaska this year, which is approximately $30 million. Opportunities for mineral development rely on the geology, gold prices, and infrastructure and access. This map here, and I apologize, I don't have a pointer, so couldn't find one at the office. This map here is put together in some invisible. I don't know if I could use it now, I'm not practiced. This map is several years old, but it was put together by Dave Magala, who's a geologist with the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geological and Geophysical Services, and Dick Swainbank, who is my counterpart in Fairbanks. And essentially, it's a real easy to look at map of mineral opportunities within Alaska. Coal, which you may be familiar with, is Point Lane, particularly the world class quantity and quality of coal access to it is not there at this point. Healy, Goose Valley, Wishbone Hill, and that is the valley. We'll find out about that. Beluga. Tintin, a gold belt, which I think Lance will speak a lot more detail about, so I'm not going to go into it, is an arc that passes through Alaska in that area. Generally, it includes the Pogo, which Carl Hunman will speak about. Fort Knox, of course, is in the Fairbanks area. Illinois Creek, which I mentioned in the mine that cut down this last. Really, by Viceroy Resources, and they're due to decide fairly soon what they're going to do with that property, whether they'll continue on or shut down. We don't have any idea at this point in time. And of course, platinum prices in there have occurred at record highs recently, so the interest is very intense right now.
Excuse me, Frankie. I both have a slight hearing loss, and I tuned you out for about half a sentence. What did you say just before the platinum?
Well, I'm talking about Fort Knox, yeah. Illinois Creek, Hudson area over here.
Did you say something about cobalt?
No, I didn't.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I can answer that. And of course, we don't want to forget about Greens Creek down here in the southeast. Zinc, lead. Gold, silver, and red dot. A lot of play. 60% of the industry in Alaska. I'm going to try and do this real quickly here. I also have a sample here of the geophysical surveys that DGGS has been doing on state lands, and they've been real exciting to have happen because they have been providers of information to industry. We've seen a lot of folks waiting patiently but excitedly for the information that comes out. And you can see this area here isn't much. In fact, it just covers this little area here and it's just body. So it's been a real good investment. Dick Swain Bank estimates, just kind of interestingly, that its current survey rate would take 70 years to complete the state land survey.
70 years?
70 years is what he estimates.
And we're in, what, the 50 years?
Yeah.
Madam Chairman, the feds wouldn't have conveyed the land to us by then anyway.
Right.
The other important thing that's happening with CGDS, of course, and we do work with them quite a bit. As you know, we produce several reports, but the other thing that has been going on is they are collecting ambient water quality data, which is real important in the decision-making process. Anyway, a lot of that information can be, of course, found. We have a website for DTD, and DGGS also has a website. We carry these various reports, which you should have gotten in your offices anyway. And if you don't, I'd be happy to provide more. It's generally an optimistic time for Alaska, believe it or not. Metal prices are increasing. There was a net increase in claims over the last year as well, which means new exploration is an indicator of the future. It's not necessarily an indicator of the present health, but it certainly gives us a look at the possibilities in the future. And then they're continuing to work on removing the uncertainty in permitting, which again equals an improved business environment in Alaska. Part of my job, of course,
Frankie, a few years ago I heard that we had some significant deposits of chromium down in the south part of the Kenai Peninsula, and I believe it found land that was owned by Cook Inlet. But do you know anything about that?
I don't personally, but
Red Mountain Mine.
I would ask you.
Yeah, it's Red
Mountain. Oh, it's Red Mountain. Yeah, I know about that. That has been around for a long time.
And as I remember, the last time I looked at it, it was not competitive at today's
prices. It's pretty remote.
Yeah.
And as I remember, we get most of our chromium from South Africa and Russia or somewhere.
Yeah.
So a change in world politics could make that stuff more valuable.
Well, I think you're seeing that right now with the platinum.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. Like I said, there's a lot of good knowledge in this room right now, so it's the time to ask the questions. I just wanted to briefly touch on some of the other work that we do at the Division of Trade and Development, and that is as support staff to the Alaska Minerals Commission. When they need it, they meet several times a year, and they also are required to produce an annual report for the legislature. I'll briefly touch on their major point in this year's report, which you should have received as well. And essentially their finding A, titled A Crisis in Alaska's Ability to Issue Permits, focuses on the loss of the DEC funding for a core institutionally knowledgeable permitting staff over the last few years. It's leaving the mining and the seafood processors, the municipal and rural sewage plant operators and oil field developers at a risk level. The ability of the private and public sector to foster economic development, improve infrastructure, and enhance the quality of life in Alaska has been reduced in the Minerals Commission's report. Essentially, the shift of DEC's water quality program from a general fund program to a user pay program, coupled with policy direction and the postponement, cancellation, or completion of projects, has reduced the fees that are coming to DEC, and therefore has reduced DEC's ability to continue employing, again, the institutionally knowledgeable core permitting staff. That concludes my presentation. I certainly could answer some questions if you have them, or I can be reached in my
Representative Helper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You did mention some permitting delays with DEC because of budget cutbacks. How is that compared to then and now? What type of a time frame or increased delay have you seen? Is there an average, or is it just?
Paul, do you want to answer that?
Well, yes. The issue is a difficult question. base of deposits that they might be able to mine and augment production from their existing facility by hauling that ore to the mill. They've gone into the DEC to negotiate a reimbursable service agreement and have, for the past period of months, been told that they can sign an agreement with the DEC to do that. Working through that, we're trying to prioritize things within the available resources to try and do, but there are literally four permit riders left in the state of Alaska. The delays will become more apparent as the project actually to the permit application stage.
I know when the Minerals Commission made their report, that was their number one issue, is that we must address having adequate people in that department to process the permitting. Frankie, thank you very much. I wanted to just say one thing. You know, we've all known there's coal along Cook Inlet that comes out on the Homer beaches, but I've never seen it put on a graph like that. That's pretty incredible.
In that regard, Frankie, I would enjoy having a copy of that map. If you would tell me or my staff how to get it,
okay.
I would really appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay, and could we also have your comments, if you would give them to Scott, so we have them to pass out to the community?
Okay.
And one last thing, I really appreciate, in light of your own personal loss this week, I really appreciate you being here. That's very, very good.
Thank you.
The next person that we will hear from is Dr. Lance Miller, who's currently president of a locally based company called Red Diamond Mining, as well as president of the Foundation for Glacier and Environmental Research, which operates the Juneau Ice Field Research Program here every summer. Dr. Miller received his PhD for a research project on the AJ Mine and the Juneau Gold Belt. He has worked extensively in the gold exploration industry across Alaska and the world, including the countries of Russia, Mexico, China, and others. Dr. Miller.
Thank you.
I think that was very impressive. And for the record, we've been joined by Representative Sisma. And the lady right behind you is our lights person, so whenever you need her to douse the lights.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, what I wanted to do today was several things. One, just give a bit of perspective about Alaska ore deposits, a bit on gold prices, why companies are looking here. And then actually do sort of a photo tour around the world very quickly, hopefully, to put Alaska in the global perspective and then come back to Alaska. So in your packets, you have several things like just draw your attention to. A few gold graphs here, just to note, as Frankie mentioned about the price of gold or metals, is going up. Gold has gone up recently, still it's pretty flat. The other two graphs I think that are important are platinum, palladium. And you can see the palladium is actually off the page here. And that also speaks to some of the things Representative Dyson was mentioning, foreign sources with Russia not being able to supply us as much platinum and palladium. Okay, I'm going to focus mainly on gold, but also touch on some other minerals. You also have a gold production graph here, which is from 94, but that still holds true today. And I'd just like to point out that why I'm going to address some of these countries in our worldwide tour, such as Australia, Russia, China, Uzbekistan, is because they are really the top gold-producing countries. And then some of you may be aware of the Fraser Report that was put out recently, and you have some of the graphs of this, but it really rates countries around the world and provinces and states in their well, in various ways, such as investment attractiveness, geological potential, and so forth. And on all these, you can see Alaska rates quite favorably. So that's good news. The bad news is actually that we know is it's a remote place to work, and you need big deposits to make them economic. And that's where the term world class comes from or comes into play. And I guess we were actually arguing or discussing that earlier, what is world-class deposit? Certainly Red Dog is world-class. I think it's, what, 8% of the world's zinc supply it gives. The Kennecott deposit up in the Wrangells, it basically was a company maker, was probably world-class. Whether Greens Creek would be or not, it's certainly rich, but it's probably not, as we were discussing earlier, a world-class deposit. Okay, and gold deposits, generally world-class deposits are deposits that are, as far as ounces, are on the order of 20, 30 million ounces in one deposit. And hopefully I'll give you a little better feeling for that when we go through the slide. Just a few other things to note. There's exploration news here attached, so you can see what companies are doing what in Alaska. This is put out by Kurt Freeman. And then also have a preface that of a publication, more sort of technical, but I was a co-editor on this book that came out in 97, Mineral Deposits in Alaska. And it was sort of timely because it was sort of the beginning of the boom of minerals. In fact, the Pogo deposit is mentioned in here, but at the time that was referred to as the Stone Boy project. So anyways, you have the preface. A bit more before I get onto the slides about, I think, the excitement toward Alaska. There was recently the Cordilleran Roundup in Vancouver, a big mining meeting. And this is a publication that was put out, and I can pass these around, about the Tintina Gold Belt. So really papers about deposits in the Yukon and Alaska. And in this session, in the morning session, there was over, I think, about 900 people attending the talk. So definitely a lot of interest. A lot of interest. Let's see how many people actually.
Now, has that occurred yet this year? Okay, so.
Is this
from this year?
This just came out in January.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is just.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
Well, I guess we better.
I guess he would be the highest bidder.
Okay, like I said, I'll try to move through this quickly. And the first part is that factor is really to give people a perspective of mainly gold deposits, as I said, some other ones, but around the world and how Alaska fits in. So, starting out, of course, we know this map. Obviously, in the Western Cordillera, two main places where companies are looking, and this comes out in that Fraser report you have, is Nevada, the carbon type deposits in Alaska.
Okay. Wait a minute, go back one, please. Yeah. The red line with the triangles on it, is that a tectonic plate?
It is. That's sort of, that's basically the boundary, the one on the left. North American.
Yeah, and the one there
that's
east of the Rockies?
That's the edge of the thrust belt where all these rocks have been pushed on.
Okay, and so that what's a batholith?
Oh boy. Good question. It's essentially a big intrusive body, like the ice fields behind us here.
Like Norm.
Anyways, like the ice, it's a big body of intrusive rock. And oftentimes it puts a lot of heat and fluids into the country rock. It cycles fluids and metals around it and helps you focus.
So is that batholith that runs there, looks like right up the coastal range virtually, does it consistently contain anything valuable?
Actually, it's on the edges of the batholith rock to find major gold deposits. Here in Nevada,
yeah.
The Mother Lode is here, Bridge River in D.C., the Juneau Gold Belt right here, even the Fairbanks District. A lot of work coming out to suggest the relationship to intrusive rock. So it's a common thing.
The batholith is intrusive. Does that mean it wasn't native to the tectonic plate?
No, it was pushed. It was put in as molten rock.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I guess I'll use some of these slides just to make viewpoint rather than getting into too much of the geology. But the tour here is really going to be from Nevada, Canada, South Africa, over Uzbekistan, a bit on China, touch on Australia, Russia, and then we'll be right back. Okay, and what these gold deposits signify is some of the major gold deposits in the world outside of really some of the South American stuff and South Africa. And you can see a big chunk of them occur right through Asia, Central Asia, and Asia. Okay, Nevada, we know mostly about Nevada, but I think it's interesting at the present time it produces, I think, about 11%, contributes 11% to the world gold production and about 70% to the United States gold production. Again, a lot of focus still here. Because the country looks like that. You can see rocks, and you can drive around them. We've talked to people recently who are interested to see what happens in Alaska, but as they say, when they can drive their truck to Tonopah, which is right near here, why should they come to Alaska? Also, I emphasize in Nevada there's huge, huge gold deposits, much bigger than what we've so far seen. This is a picture of Timmins. And but this is a head frame right there, so that's where the building that holds the hoist to go underground. And this is right in the middle of Timmins. The head frame that goes to the or the mine below that produced about 20 million ounces of gold right there. Okay. So again, a lot of concentrated gold in some of these major deposits. Well, perhaps one of the more statements for what a gold industry can do is South Africa. And this is a picture of Johannesburg. This city was really totally built from mining. In fact, there are shafts in the middle of town that are not used anymore. South Africa has contributed about 40% of humankind's gold, 1.4 billion ounces of gold, essentially coming from an area about 300 kilometers. There's social issues there. This is outskirts of Soweto. People have probably heard about it. It's the largest black town south of the equator, about 3 million people there. A lot of these people came to South Africa and other parts of Africa to work in the mines. The mines are getting deep. They are narrow. They are high grade. Many of these deposits, individual deposits, will be 20, 50, 80 million ounces. But as I say, they are deep. Getting expensive, also due to social issues in South Africa and crime and the like. Many of the big companies are actually moving off to go to Canada, like Anglo Gold. Okay, another interesting part of the world for big gold deposits is in Uzbekistan along the Silk Road, about 2,500 years of history left here. But it's predominantly Muslim. And it's also predominantly a region of arid desert, steppe-like country. This is a yurt you see scattered throughout. But what it has there is one deposit, essentially, one gold deposit called Murrintown. And basically, within this pit, it's about 300 meters deep and long, couple about 2.5 kilometers long. There's a resource of 140 million ounces of gold. So this makes Uzbekistan, on your chart, it might be seventh. I think today it might even be fifth in the world for gold resources. There are some other big deposits, but these are the kind of deposits that are out there and why especially bigger companies have been looking in these some of these far-flung parts of the world and what potentially Alaska has to compete against. China, of course, another one. It has a long history of mining, a lot of gold. This is just a map showing a certain part of China, northeast China, right here, where about 80% of China's gold reserves occur. Like I mentioned, too, China's about the same size.
And those yellow marks were gold, not batholith.
No, that's right. But there are some batholiths in there, I can show you. But yeah, mainly they are gold. A long history, again, I think this is an interesting picture to show this. This is the mine we went to. Again, a head frame, a hoist for going underground, and a basketball court. So this town, everything's intertwined very tightly here in the mine. When you get to economics, that brings a whole different issue, because there's 1,000 people working underground here in North America. There are 300, so you just can't go in. Some other resources, though, that are in China and in North China, Inner Mongolia specifically, this is the Bayanobo rare earth deposit that supplies 70% of the rare earth elements. They are modernizing, but you can see here there's a mule carrying a little tool on the set. Nonetheless, this mine is still producing an incredible amount of resource. And there's a lot of potential in China. This is a view of Inner Mongolia looking toward north toward Mongolia. However, I think recently we've seen the problems with working in China and getting deals done. Okay, now we'll touch a little bit on Australia and then go into this area and the Russian Far East. Australia, Russian Far East, to give you an idea of how it fits together with past gold production, a pie chart representing several hundred million ounces of gold. Alaska here, that represents about 30 million ounces. So you can see how much has come out of actually California, mainly placer deposits, out of eastern Australia and the Russian Far East. So really some incredible amount. Work is ongoing in Australia, however, they're really having a slump in their mineral industry. This is a drill rig in the gum tree forest in Australia there. And Australian companies are looking over in this part of the world as well. Okay, Russia. We all know where it is, of course, but I like this perspective because it really shows. And we're going to be talking about this part of Russia, which essentially is equivalent to. The resources there, this is kind of a busy slide. The main thing to get away from this is the black dots are gold deposits, low gold deposits. The circles, the red dashed outlines are placer. In this area, there is a resource of about 350 million ounces of gold. Okay, again, significant. Lots of placer mining going on there. Want to show you a few pictures of Siberia of what is apparently, we've been told, the world's largest undeveloped gold resource. This is called the Two Point Log. We're actually, Scott and I worked a picture of the drill rig there in 1998. And you have to be flexible in Russia. Here's Mr. Petzl.
Our so one
you,
and only.
Just so you know, he potentially does have KGB connection. So, that was great. Okay, just a view of one of the volcanoes in Kamchatka. And I think, so we're getting really close to Alaska here, okay, with the slideshow. So, what, you know, and this is maybe a good way to lead into it, because lots of times we know about the money that's gone down the tube, or in some way. I like this headline, though, ruble drops, prices rise, people die. There's been a lot of hype, and when we were over there, we did work through the economic crisis. You can get things done, great people, a lot of potential, but it is bureaucratic, and the Soviet mentality still hangs. So there are problems, and there's the wild Siberian women here. But it has potential, but I think it's because of these things that have happened in the last decade, basically. Opening up of the Soviet Union, so Uzbekistan, Russia, and China. There was a big, you know, flight of people going there, but finding it really tough to get stuff done. Brings us back to Alaska. Frankie mentioned the Tintina Gold Belt, sort of outlined in yellow here through Alaska and Yukon. And this has a resource, current resource, about 50 million ounces, past production 30. Okay, so remember, some of the deposits in South Africa. Has almost twice the reserve in one deposit as this whole region. So these are some of the things that a mining company has to look at, and that I think the state of Alaska has to recognize when trying to attract business. All right, here's the geology short course. So hang with me. I was thinking about this, how to do it. I want to talk about a couple of major deposit types, really two ways. One are ones that form in ocean basins. Several hundred million years ago, this is what Alaska looked like. Here's the outline. There was nothing there. So
basically there are rocks along the edge of North America. This, in this setting, is where many of the big deposits were formed or intruded into. This is Spokane Mountain, southeast Alaska, which is North America's largest yttrium rare earth element deposit. Red Dog, of course, we all know about. Kennecott deposit, a bit plain and tilting a bit. Another successor deposit, Greens Creek, also formed in this sort of setting, either along the North American continent or in an ocean setting just offshore. And just up the road here is a view of Telsquat Chief in Canada, and Windy Crank is a similar type of deposit. Okay, then all of a sudden, in the Cretaceous, about 100 million years ago, Alaska started to take the shape by all these terrains coming in, take the shape of what we see today. Okay, so without getting into detail, it was really the last 100 million years things started happening, and we started getting gold deposits in place. Southeast Alaska, southwest Alaska, Seward Peninsula, and up around the Fairbanks. Examples of those, of course, in southwest Alaska, the mercury gold deposits around Red Devil and Donlin Creek. And Donlin Creek is actually, even now, even though it's not in production and it's tough to make it economic in these prices, it's a success story just about a partnership that happened between or is going on between Chalisa and Placer Dome, for one thing. This is a view looking north with some of the roads and trenches. And secondly, it's Alaska's largest gold resource, about 11.4 million. Okay, also, we have Fort Knox deposit. This was stolen off the internet, an isometric view of Pogo deposit. I'm sure Carl's seen this in a lot of presentations. And then also in this period of time, last 100 million years, the AJ deposit, of course, right above us here, Treadwell across the channel. And then there's a couple other pretty significant deposits that likely will never be developed for a long time. This is Brady Glacier, copper nickel, 100 million tons, including platinum palladium credit.
Where is that at?
That's in Glacier Bay, up in the Brady Ice Field, up by Mount Fairweather, Mount Sterling.
Federal land?
Yes. So it's in the park. Well, yeah, there is some. But is it still?
Right? Yeah, it's Bums University of Alaska.
Oh, does it?
Yes.
So they could actually get some royalties from that. Think of that. There
it is. Mark Hamilton.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good one. And then on Quartz Hill. Again, huge. Okay, so, but some of the issues here in Alaska, as we know, don't want to dwell on, is the access. Things are remote, hard to get to. It takes a lot of time and a lot of money to get a project even to a stage where you can bring it into. And that is a problem when companies are looking at this. Okay, so, with that, the slides, kind of a whirlwind tour. Yeah, I forgot the light. Jeez, there, thanks. But what I really want to do is try to put Alaska into perspective in the world. And while on one hand, it has an incredible mineral wealth and potential, it has a long ways to go to compete with the rest of the world. Okay. So I think with that, since we started a bit late, I should hold off unless there's any questions.
Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Any of the old Kennecott copper mines, is there any circumstances that will make them economic?
Most of the copper there, those mines were actually pretty unique deposits, so they were all in one place, mined out, basically. And secondly, they're in the park. So,
somebody told me that several of the old mining districts that with modern technology, it's worth going through the tailing piles for maybe.
It depends on the deposit. Yeah. I think, again, a thing to stress here is that deposits that you could get into in Nevada or Mexico or other place like that, they have to be,
a lot easier.
Twice as good here. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your report. That was very, very good, and we appreciate it. We'll probably be back to you at some point in time in the future.
No worries.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Our next presenter is Carl Hanneman. He's the Alaska Regional Manager for Tech Resources, operator of the Pogo Deposit near Delta Junction, and is based in Fairbanks. He's also a board member of the Alaska Minerals Commission. It's really nice to have all you guys down here with us.
Well, I sure appreciate the invitation and always happy to do it. And it's certainly my pleasure to just update you on the Pogo project. I was down last spring when we were in the process of applying for permits to proceed with this underground exploration. And now we've got almost a year of exploration under our belt. Have not yet intersected the ore body. So the work is just to drive this tunnel in to with the goal of intersecting the ore body to do engineering information. And I want to be respectful of your time. I have some slides here that I'll spin through and just kind of give you a brief update on project status. And
great. Mark, would you catch the light, please? Great, that'll be wonderful.
So, Pogo is a joint venture between TAC Resources and Sumitomo. TAC has several operations worldwide, primarily in Canada, but also in Chile and Australia. They have a revenue mix that's distributed amongst gold, base metals, and coal. And TAC also owns 44% of Cominco, which, of course, is the operator of the Red Dog mine. That's ownership is through an equity interest in Cominco.
Carl, do they have any ownership in the Cominco project across the inlet by Augustine?
Well, their ownership of Cominco is equity interest in the company.
Total.
So
okay.
As a result, they own. They also, like for example, in the Polaris mine in northern Canada, they have a direct interest in the project as well as their indirect interest through Cominco. But and they also involved with Abacus Minerals in the exploration of the Nibbot project near Ketchikan, as well as other regional exploration throughout Alaska. This is a map, a location map, northeast of Delta Junction. The Stoneboy name is that what it's now called the Pogo Project, but Stoneboy was actually a joint venture put together by WGM back in 1981 that was going to look in a large region here in the upper Salter River, upper Good Pasture area, and they were, in fact, going to focus on an area that was called Stoneboy at the time, which is now many miles from where Pogo actually is. So it just shows that the exploration started in a large regional context, and they gradually worked down and prioritized in the Pogo area. This is a view looking down what's called Lisa Creek to the Good Pasture Valley. The Pogo deposit lies underneath this hill at or below the level of the stream. So all the exploration and drilling that's been done since 1994 has been done on this hill through helicopter-supported drill pads and drill sites. Here's a picture of a drill there doing some of the exploration. Geologists pulling up the core and logging the core, looking for the quartz vein that contains the gold. This is a 3D model put together with the drill holes shown, and the solid of the quartz vein. There's actually two zones here, an upper and a lower zone. In cross-section, then, this shows the drill holes coming down here, and the blue, in this case, is the upper zone, and the purple is the lower zone. So, you know, it's not quite a needle in the haystack, but it is, you have to try to do a lot of drilling to define this potential gold vein that ultimately contains the gold resource.
What's in the green and the yellow there?
The green is just a different type of rock. These are metamorphic rocks where the pressure of all this tectonic activity has consolidated the rock, and these are just kind of different geochemistry of a similar type of rock. So that drilling has shown then, updated through the 1999 resource estimate of 5.6 million ounces of gold, so it's certainly not the hundreds of million that Lance was talking about, but it is a significant resource at today's price, about $1.5 billion in place value, and that, of course, is what's attracting Teck and Sumitomo to pursue its development. Once that resource was identified, we started these baseline studies looking at air quality, water quality, fisheries in the river, a whole suite of very detailed scientific studies. We're currently in phase two and phase three. Phase two is this underground exploration. Phase three is environmental assessment feasibility study, and yet to come will be permitting, construction, operation, and ultimate reclamation and closure. So this phase two now is to tunnel into the ore body to get this engineering information about rock conditions, water flow, and the extent of the mineralization, the continuity of the mineralization. And so just in a cross-section, looking into Pogo Ridge, it shows just kind of a schematic of how the tunnel will go down and come up in underneath the gold deposit. So equipment to do that exploration was hauled over Winter Road a couple of winter ago, 97-98. A camp was constructed there on a site from an old placer miner. This underground equipment was hauled in, and then a bunch of work was done to kind of help design just the underground exploration stage, about a year's season's worth of technical work on rock geochemistry, water drainage, that kind of thing. There's a aerial view looking at after the camp was established in the summer of 1998, but prior to actually starting the adit, which was collared right in this location, going back into Pogo Ridge in that direction. So that winter, we constructed a winter airstrip out on the river. It didn't have a winter road. Went through an application process with the agency, and we received our permits on March 4 and actually began construction on March 5. And the point I'd like to make here is that the state of Alaska DNR kind of coordinated the states and in part the both federal agencies as well in responding to comments and working through this permitting process. And we couldn't have done it timely without that good coordination. So the elements of just the exploration at this stage is to construct this, the portal up here, a road up the hill, and an area to store the rock. At this point, there's no gold being recovered. There's no chemicals being used. It's just a matter of having to pull the rock out and store it on its pad. Winter airstrip flying materials into the site. Beginning construction up at the portal pad. Clearing area for the rock pads, construction of the road up the hill, and making this area to place a liner under which we'd place the rock. We placed this liner not because we were required to, but because we had some test data that showed there could be a potential problem of rainwater causing some leachate from these rocks, and we wanted to essentially do a large test during this exploration stage so that for ultimate development we'd be able to make better plans. Picture of the liner being placed. And here's the essentially the complete footprint, which we of course started this March and finished most of this work by near the end of April. You can still see the ice here along the river. And it was real critical from the permit processing standpoint that we get the go-ahead in time to get out here and do all this work on the frost while the ground was still frozen and back get our footprint complete and intact before the seasonal thaw came. So the whole purpose of going there was to start this exploration tunnel, adit we call it, picture of the underground workers there marking up the face, drillings done at each intersection here, and loaded with explosives, and advance about 10 feet per round, and with good luck, you get 2 rounds per day. So it's a slow process. Takes a lot of focused effort. Contractor from Delta installing a water treatment plant underground to treat the water that was going to drain from this tunnel. Here's a picture of the water treatment plant that was installed underground. Aerial shot this summer then of the portal pad and the kind of the shop facility placed up there to support the generator, air compressor, fans, and all the things needed to do the underground work. A little view from farther away. Now this is the footprint then that'll be in place for the next couple of years as we then go through feasibility and permitting of larger production facility. So the phase three then, environmental assessment feasibility is ongoing. Baseline studies are ongoing. We're looking at tailings placement methods and locations. This will be an underground mine. So the closest example we have of that is Green Street, of course, where there'll be a mill facility. This is a picture of Green Street. There'll be a mill facility established at the surface, probably up on top of Pogo Ridge, with access to the deposit through shaft. But overall, it'll have a relatively compact footprint. Another shot of Green Street. The size of the mine in terms of the rock process today will be on the same order as Green Street. It'll be an underground mine. This picture from one of Teck's underground mines in Canada, showing this operator back here is operating this loader by remote control, stands back here and runs joysticks, and that helps to improve safety and also the efficiency of the operation. We don't know that this will be how Pogo will be run, but there's that opportunity. So starting at the surface here, the tunnel now has progressed down. We're now about right here, seeking to get to the ore and the optimum way to develop it. We'll also do some drilling down to a third zone, which we're optimistic. It has 2 drill holes in it now, and we're hopeful that additional drilling can expand the resource there. And big issues kind of in evaluating the potential development of the deposit include the infrastructure development. How are we going to get power? Are we going to have an on-site power or power line? And how we might access with options of air access, winter road, or all-season road.
How long would the all-season road be?
About 50 miles.
Any really tough area to cover, build roads on?
It depends on the route that might be selected. There is some route, ridge routes, I'll just show you just briefly here, that are quite difficult, but there's one route that, from a technical standpoint, would be quite difficult.
Is there any insurmountable right-of-way acquisition problems?
We don't think so.
Dale's friend Clinton hasn't declared any of it.
Well, it's fortunately all state land.
Carl, this is one of the roads that our committee selected as, you know, for pushing through a road to a development process or to a development project. The Pogo Road is one of our committee's priorities.
You can see here that here's the existing road network in Alaska, and this. Short segment there would be what would be required to access Pogo. But we're looking at 3 options now. We're trying to evaluate the economics and the reliability and practicality of each option. The first would involve using a winter road up the existing Good Pasture winter trail for construction, and then for the life of the project to just access through a large airstrip, a 5,000-foot airstrip up on top of Pogo Ridge. The second scenario would be to construct a winter road annually, either using the existing winter trail up the Good Pasture River, which is potentially problematic in that it has 9 river crossings, and there's a lot of ice bridges and attention that needs to be paid to make sure those river crossings are appropriate. Or there's the option of using existing winter trails up the Shaw Creek Flats, which have been constructed over the years, first by the military, and then subsequently, and in the last 10 years, used several winters on small timber sales in this area. So there has been winter roads up to this point, but from here up to the northeast to the Pogo project itself would require new winter road construction. And then the third scenario is an all-season road, and kind of two concepts to use for construction of an all-season road. One would be to stay to the ridge line, to stay in the high country, which is the South Ridge route or the North Ridge route. The other option for an all-season road would be to stay down here on the south-facing slope, which is a lot flatter grade and a lot more constructible.
Are those streams are crossing there, and where that lower, flatter road be, are any of those produce a lot of fish?
No, we have initiated baseline fish studies on there. We know that there are grayling. We know that the lower part of the Shaw Creek Basin does host juvenile salmon. These streams all in the upper reach here are probably all blocked by beaver dams. We know part of it is what's interconnected and what isn't. We're not sure. We're trying to understand that. But Fish and Game does not consider any of this part of the upper Shaw Creek drainage a significant sediment stream. But as well, anything that we might propose in here would include bridges and essentially de minimis effect on the stream in any event. They're not small streams. You know, I personally waded across these without getting my knees wet. And looking ahead as far as project potential, looking at the $200-$250 million construction cost, a annual production on the same order as the existing Fort Knox production, 10 to 15 year mine life, and 200 to 300 year round high quality private sector jobs. And that's just a shot of the operation this winter. They've continued on through the winter, of course, still going, and we'd expect to reach the deposit optimistically within the next month, and then continue with the engineering work beyond that.
Great. It's really encouraging to see how far you guys have gotten. That's wonderful.
Well, it's still the exploration stage. We anticipate kicking off an EIS probably sometime in the third quarter, if we can do our homework and get enough engineering work to support that done in time. And then that'll initiate a, we hope to be a 16, 18 month process. 2 years.
Good. And then keep looking for other deposits under there or around there.
Drills are still turned.
Yeah, good. Judy, do you want to get the light?
That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you very much, Carl. Are there any other questions of Carl? Representative Roper.
Yes,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They're all great to see you. Yeah. Talked on the phone for over the years.
Right, you bet.
The looking at the different routes back there, you mentioned there were some timber sales up in the Chalk Creek Valley and other things. Is there other, by putting a permanent road back in there, what other types of either resources or recreational other type opportunities would be opened up by putting a year-round road back in there?
Well, there's we understand that there's different perspectives out there in terms of whether the opportunity to harvest timber or access recreational opportunities is either a positive or a negative thing. So we're not trying to we don't want to suggest which it should be, but there are timber resources up there. The state forest does go up to Shaw Creek Valley. Beyond that, there as far as other resources or other opportunities, there's none to my knowledge, but you know, kind of opportunity is in the eye of the beholder.
Right. What about is that the Good Pasture River you land on there?
Yes, the Good Pasture River. We land on a gravel bar of the Good Pasture. Well, the fishing is excellent. Of course, our consultants tell us that because they have to fish too. But we have a policy that no employees can fish because we don't want to adversely affect the local resource. So it's one of those things where we know the fishing is very good, but haven't experienced it ourselves. It's grayling primarily. King salmon come up the river, and there are they think about 1,000, 600 to 1,000 actual spawning salmon in the whole river, based on the research that we've been doing. But of course, they're not. That's not an open season fishable item. There.
Right, anyway. Lots of going to. It's kind of strange. We live in Alaska.
Yeah, but we can't fish this river.
To let us civilians go back in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. There's anybody that gets in up there on their own.
Right. Yeah, right.
You know, but we realize that we're just bringing 50 or 60 people into a site that hasn't had a lot of impact. And the Good Pasture, there's quite a number of property owners on the Good Pasture that enjoy the recreational fishing as well, and
you folks were able to work out a pretty good agreement with those people when you put that first winter road in, right?
I would more likely characterize it as an intensive management
right.
effort.
We were following that with interest.
But in the end, now the property owners saw that winter road could be done without any significant adverse effect. They love the fact that rather than the willows beating their snow machines up, that now it's a widened trail that they're dragging regularly to keep the willows from growing back, and can now scoot to the river quite readily. But you know, as to whether that's a viable long-term access option or not, we're not sure because of the river issues and those.
Well, we will continue our work in this committee on working with
appreciate your
everybody
interest.
Concerned on that road.
Appreciate your interest in that, and I know access really is the key to kind of the project development, however it occurs.
Right. Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I would like to also introduce to everybody our representative from the project for the next. The district for the next project, and Representative Carl Morgan is here. And the last presenter we have today is June McAtee. And June is Vice President of Natural Resources for the Calista Corporation, which owns the mineral rights to the Donlin Creek project, and that's in Representative Morgan's district. June, welcome. Carl, if you'd like to come to the table, please do.
Good evening. I'm June McAtee. I manage land for Calista Corporation in southwestern Alaska, which is, as you probably are aware, the area between Norton Sound and Bristol Bay. I'm here to provide an update on the Donlin Creek project, which is a gold exploration program conducted by Placer Dome on Chalista's land near the village of Crooked Creek, about 12 to 15 miles off the Kuskokwim River. Placer Dome began work on the property in 1995, although Chalista and others have done work on the property previous to that. Placer Dome's lease with Chalista mandates shareholder hire and training, scholarship contributions, and joint venture opportunities for Chalista to provide services, supplies for the project. I don't have slides to put up, but you do have some things in your packet in hard copy that describe the project. Placer spent about $30 million to date on the property since 1995. They completed more than 400 drill holes. They have a resource, geologic resource there of 11.5 million. It's called a resource because it does not have an economic definition to it. That's the gold that they know is in the ground. There has not been an economic study done, so it's not quantified as a reserve. And there's no production on the property. It's still an exploration project. Placer has been working towards doing economic studies and have done kind of a rough cut study to look at the economics of the area. What they've discovered so far is that development in Western Alaska is pretty formidable. As you saw on the slide that was up, the road system, it's nowhere near Donlin Creek. And there's an abysmal lack of surface transportation infrastructure in Western Alaska, which makes it doubtful whether these kinds of projects can be developed economically. We've already seen two projects, hard rock projects in Western Alaska crater because of the economics. These were completely air-dependent projects. And it was just, especially when gold prices dropped out, became too difficult to keep them economic. So because of the remote location, the only way that heavy freight could be transported to the site would be by barge traffic. We have a 100-day barge season in that part of the world. Placer Dome estimates it would take 400 barges a year to supply the project, particularly in the construction phase. A fair amount of that would be fuel. So you're talking about a lot of fuel barges on a highly important Salmon River. Nearly all of the Kuskokwim and its tributaries are anadromous, including Crooked Creek, which Donlin Creek drains into. I think, trying to anticipate four barges a day, in traffic, of course, you're not going to be able to travel a full 100 days every season. The Kuskokwim River is considerably smaller and shallower than the Yukon, so some years there is no barge traffic that gets past Aniak. So barge traffic is problematical. And one of the great problems for this project. The other one is the lack of power out in the region. Placer Dome anticipates that a mill that would be required to process this type of low-grade refractory ore would require about a 50-megawatt plant. That size plant is larger than the combined demand in all the villages in our region. And there are about 50 of them out there, including Bethel. So it's a sizable demand, and that's mainly because of the type of ore that it is. It requires autoclaving. And that requires a lot of energy. So Chalista is now looking at transportation infrastructure and power is one of the critical, the two critical components to economic development in the region. Getting back to our agreement with Placer Dome, the other slide that you have in your packet is one showing the shareholder hire, the employment over the life of the project since Placer Dome began. It shows a number of shareholders, Calista shareholders, or descendants who were employed there. The wage going into our villages, the percentage of workforce, and I have to commend Placer Dome for keeping at least a 50% portion of the workforce in local hire, which is unusual for an exploration project, you know, because of the kinds of work that are done. The training that Placer provided for people in the region has enabled them to be geotechnicians, drillers' assistants, drillers, mechanics, transportation, logistics specialists, shareholder hire specialists, you know, so that more and more of the camp is actually run by people from the region. It's given them ownership in the project. It's on native land, and because of the number of people who work there, they have a firsthand view of the project, and they've derived a pretty good benefit in wages in a region that has very, very few opportunities for earning a living wage. Another large contribution is Placer Dome from the get-go made this zero-tolerance, drug-free workplace and required mandatory drug testing to be hired, and then random drug testing over the course of the summer, you know, when people are there working. To my knowledge, this is the first time this has ever been required in this part of the world. And it was kind of a revelation. But I think was probably also the first project that Placer worked on that had the same policy, which applied to everyone. And they were so impressed with the results that I've heard the project manager say that he would never work on another project unless it had the same requirements. So, and that has contributed to less violence overall in the villages when people go home due to less drinking in an area that has sometimes had some pretty serious problems in that regard. Other contributions that this project has made to the Central Kuskokwim region include banking, which was virtually unheard of before then. People have banking accounts. They have retirement funds, you know, that were the first time. One of the things that the company did was bring bankers out to the site and to the villages and sign people up for accounts. You know. So it's contributed to improve buying power. It's enlarged villagers' viewpoints about the economy beyond the village and how they fit into that. We've developed now a core of highly trained people who can work on these kinds of projects in other parts of the state, and actually have gone on with some of our joint venture partners like Bert Longyear Drilling, and worked on other projects, some of them up in the Fairbanks area. So the project is still alive. There's going to be a geophysical program done this year on the ground and some trenching. There's a possibility of further drilling. At this point, Placer is looking at other areas on the project besides the Lewis area, which is where the 11.5 million ounces were defined, to look for other targets. So they're looking for potential high grades. secondary ore bodies, you know, that could be exploited here as well. So their specialty is geology. That's what they do best, and that's, they're working very hard at it. Are there any questions?
Let me just make a comment that this, the Donlin Creek Mine, was one of the other road projects that our committee focused on. And when we chose to work on road projects, we said they'd have to go to a resource area. So we did focus on the road between Crooked Creek and Donlin Creek.
Mm-hmm.
I think as long as the legislature can assist in those kind of infrastructure things, that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Dyson?
I slept since our meeting, so where was the road from Donlin Creek Mine going to go?
From Crooked Creek to Donlin, to connect the Crooked Creek
to
the river.
Just down to the river.
Right.
Yeah.
Still then, so then my question for you, June, is, you know, what's the alternative to barging?
One of the alternatives is a railroad. And this has come up repeatedly from time to time from people in Western Alaska, most notably Nome. But I think that railroads would be a good fit for this region because they wouldn't, you know, the rail line wouldn't be choked with Winnebagos, which is, I think, what would happen if you built, you know, a public road into that area. That would provide some control over the amount of traffic coming out there, but it would provide a freight transportation system at reasonable cost, where you could bring in fairly large items.
We got it all the way up to Red Dog. We could hook it into the Arctic Cold Project and
yes.
bring you power, also yes. cheaper power.
Exactly. And there are coal deposits in the McGrath right. area that are also exploitable. They're not that far away, right. but, you know, they might as well be, you know, across Bering Strait.
A million miles.
Yeah. And part of their problem is lack of access as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's really a problem for all of us. And Steve and I have had part of this conversation, and I think the industry and the state needs to have it. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not wanting to raise taxes on the industry. But it's like the tourist industry that comes to us and says, build more facilities, build more places for people to go. And roads for him to get there and more outhouses and so on and so forth. And the state's present fiscal situation, the state has to kind of say, where are we going to get the money? And then they say, well, our industry provides so many jobs, but without state sales tax or income tax, there's no way that any money comes back into the state to either give us the seed money to build the infrastructure, you know, or pay off bonds or whatever else. It's a problem that we need to jointly, I'm speaking to, you know, everybody here in the industry, figure out a way to solve, a way that will make so many of these projects viable, you know, in the way that the state can provide because of its both financial strength and tax-free status to build the infrastructure, but some way or another to, you know, to pay for that and in a way that somehow or the other the parts of the industry that do really well, you know, and making a lot of money, or when they start making money, to get to participate in paying off the infrastructure that made it so that they could make the money. I'm sure all of you sweat more brains every day than I've ever had and can figure out how to do that. But it's certainly something from my perspective that needs to be addressed by people with a lot more experience than me.
Representative Roper?
Thank you. Chair. Ms. McAtee, do you think that the people and the members of the Chavista region would, do you think they're really opposed to a road into the YK Delta area? You mentioned a railroad to keep the Winnebagoes out.
Yeah.
I've done this for some time.
Right, yeah.
On the one hand, you want economic development, on the other hand, you seem to be reluctant to embrace any kind of transportation system that might be workable.
I'd like to see things come in stages. I think building a public highway out there would be, you'd be getting to the end stage first. That's kind of a hard way to go. But I do see that there is more and more demand as the years go by for some sort of surface transportation, because even the people in the villages need to go someplace, you know, and you know, more of them are now able to purchase vehicles, for instance, and if your whole road system is 2 miles long, you know, you can't take it very far. So especially in the central Kuskokwim area, the Kuskokwim Corporation has been advocating for surface transportation in their area for quite a long while. They're also the ones would be most highly impacted by the Donlin Creek project. More of their shareholders work there than any of our other villages because of the proximity to the project. So I think that there's potential for road systems, but I'm not so sure that building a road off the Parks Highway, for instance, down to there is going to be an easy thing to do as a first stage.
Just to follow up there, I seem to get the feeling that you're concerned about a clash of past, clash of culture, and the introduction of, let's say, tourism and the rest of the United States and North America in the region.
Well, I think it's the same sort of problem that...
Am I wrong here, or
well,
what?
No, not really. I'm thinking of the Hall Road for so many years that served industry to the North Slope. It wasn't a public road at the time, and it would have been kind of hard to do a public road considering the amount of freight that was being hauled over it and the sort of primitive condition of the road. It's only been in the last few years that the public has really been able to access that road when some of those kinds of issues are solved. And I think that that would be a logical way to open up that country would be for a road dedicated to industry, to freight hauling. Railroads would be one easy way to do that, you know, but there are other kinds of alternatives like the Hall Road.
I don't think we get federal railroad dollars. Mm-hmm. Do we? Mm-hmm. Matching dollars? Oh, really?
Steven puts it in all the time.
Oh, well, I just wasn't aware there was a national rail highway program.
Representative Halco.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Roekberg's question about a public road reminds me of that bumper sticker that you occasionally see that says, "Welcome to Alaska, now go home." June, it's my understanding that Senator Stevens, through an appropriation by Senator Stevens, that he procured $500,000 for design work on the road to the mine. In last I heard that you were waiting for that check to be cut, if you will. Can you give us an update on that?
No, I can't. I really cannot give any updates on where appropriations have gone or what's happening to them. I know they've been made. But I'm sort of out of the loop on what progress is. I don't even know who to contact
I'll know who to contact on that.
Well, I think we got the word from Richard Romer that they were successful in getting $500,000 from Senator Stevens and that they were simply waiting to receive it through DOT.
We could check with Stevens' office and see what the status on that is. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, June. And again, I want to thank everybody that was here today. I know that this is a topic of great interest to many of the legislators, and we appreciate the input. And I understand that there's a reception tonight at the Baranoff that the Alaska Miners are putting on. So, everybody better get down there quick. But thank you all very much for the presentations. That was very valuable. I particularly like this type of